Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you from a slightly happier place than our last Tennis Podcast. The world is a slightly happier place because dogs are to return to the White House. Champ and Major, two German Shepherds. One of them a rescue, the White House's first ever rescue dog, momentous occasion. They will be moving in January. Happy days.
I mean, what more could you need than that? That as a reason, I mean, that's enough on its own, aside from everything else. What sort of history is there of dogs in the White House, do we know?
Oh, up until 2016, a beautiful, illustrious history of dogs in the White House. The Obamas had a couple, I remember. Bill Clinton had, a black lab. Dogs in the White House is very much a thing, or had been until 2016, something that Bruce Springsteen, of course, pointed out in one of his bits of campaign materials. But yeah, Champ and Major, two German Shepherds. They look lovely, and they are a very welcome addition to world democracy. Matt?
Yes, that is the big news of the weekend.
So, yeah, that's what's been happening in the world. How are you feeling? Are you still glued to CNN, Matt? How have you filled the CNN void in your life? Are you still following the as yet incomplete Arizona count by the minute?
No, I'm not actually. I have detached myself from CNN since Saturday or Sunday. I finally let go. I feel like I've made some friends there, though. I'll probably be checking in on them every now and again over the next 4 years, I think. I mean, I really did admire their coverage and their broadcasting, and it really did make me feel a lot more informed about the election than I've ever been and had been before. So, yes, I feel like I owe them some sort of commitment in the future, but it's been quite nice for the last 24 hours to have let go, because literally it was on the entire time, and it was fortunate because it meant I did see the moment that they called it. I think they were the first ones, and I know a lot of people had it on for four straight days and then kind of missed the actual moment. My sister was complaining about that, but I did have it on in the background.
I fell asleep with CNN on for two consecutive nights, and I dreamt about John King on both of those nights. So
right.
That is the
details.
Weird Twilight Zone vortex. That, well, I was just sort of in the room with him while he was doing his touchscreen analysis. I was just sort of there and part of it, which was great. It was great. I hope, John King, that you are having a lovely long sleep, if you're listening, which I'm sure you are.
I mean, we've listened enough to him.
Yes, so, exactly. You know. It would only be polite. Now, while all that was happening, there was also tennis unfolding in Paris, a tournament that was won by Daniil Medvedev in three sets yesterday in the final over Alexander Zverev. We are going to be talking about that and other significant results from Paris this week. We're going to be looking ahead to Linz, the final remaining WTA tournament of the year, which is just getting underway as we record on Monday, and also the tournament in Sofia this week on the ATP tour, breaking news, Rafael Nadal did not enter qualifying in Sofia. So Novak Djokovic is the confirmed year-end number one for a sixth time. But unfortunately, we have to start off with something that is sort of a bigger and more significant story than all of that. And a very, very unpleasant one. We've covered it briefly up until now in our previous two podcasts, and as we said, I think on Thursday we were expecting this big interview done by Ben Rothenberg, as it turns out, in Racquet magazine, one of the publications that he contributes to, not the New York Times as we were expected, but in Racquet magazine, a big interview, an account from Olya Sharapova, the former girlfriend of Paris finalist Alexander Zverev, who has made allegations of physical and emotional abuse against Alexander Zverev. Now, as I said, this was a very, very in-depth account that she gave Ben Rothenberg in Racquet magazine. They spent 2 hours together at a family friend's house in New Jersey, a family friend of Sharapova. I would urge you to read the piece so that you can hear her story for yourself and make up your own minds about how you feel about it. But it's certainly an incredibly harrowing and saddening account. It's very, very difficult to read. She details allegations of abuse taking place at the 2019 US Open, at the Laver Cup in 2019, a number of incidents she alleges at Zverev's home in Monaco over the course of that year. She doesn't go into detail about the end of their relationship. She said that's something she may or may not tell at a later date, but she talks about having her head hit against the wall, about being smothered with a pillow. She talks about making an attempt on her own life during this period. It's an incredibly distressing account, and it's one that has been put to Alexander Zverev over the course of the week in Paris. He obviously released that Instagram statement a week ago, at the time that Sharapova initially made the allegations on her own Instagram. We read out Zverev's statement at the time. But since this more detailed account from Sharapova came out, Zverev has been given the opportunity to comment further on it after his first round win over Misha Kecmanovic in Paris. He was asked, I think this was on Wednesday, he was asked, "I wanted to find out, how do you manage to stay so focused with your tennis on court, with everything that you've been having to deal with off the court?" He said, Zverev, "Well, I'm here to play tennis. So, you know, I've been doing that well the last few weeks. I mean, since the comeback of the season, I want to continue doing that." As you said, there is obviously a little bit of things going on. There is some very good news. I think, yeah, I'm happy to be here and playing tennis. There was a follow-up question in that same press conference. The question was, given those allegations against you by your ex-girlfriend of domestic abuse, I know you said on social media they are unfounded and simply not true. My question is whether you're planning on doing anything else to clear your name. And he said, "Look, right now, as I said, I've said everything on my Instagram. Yeah, there is nothing else I can add right now. I'm here to play tennis. I mean, the relationship, as I said, has been over for a very long time. I'm enjoying my time on court. I've said everything. They are not true. And there is nothing more I can say right now." He was asked on Thursday about the allegations, the specifics of the allegations at the Laver Cup last year and at his Monaco apartment. The question was, "Do you have any response to this? Did these incidents take place?" Zverev said, "Well, as I said before, I think I've said everything on my Instagram. There is nothing more I can say to that. As I said, they're not true. And I hope that, yeah, as I said, I've said everything." Then on Friday, after Zverev beat Stan Wawrinka, he was asked again, "Can you say, are you considering legal action in response to these allegations? And if not, then why not?" He said, "So far, I've said everything. I've said everything in my statement. There is nothing more that I can say right now." And on Saturday, after that impressive win over Rafael Nadal, Zverev was asked once again, the last time you had some personal stuff off court with your former manager, your tennis took a toll. It was a struggle for you. Yet this time, you've not reacted this way to off-court issues. I'm just wondering if you learned something from what you went through off-court last time that is helping you through this sort of mentally put everything else out of your mind. He said, me as a person, I think I do realise now that there is going to always be people that will not want the best for you. And there is always going to be people that try to put you down when you're on top. It's up to me if I'm going to let that happen. I'm doing quite a good job of not letting that happen, and I'm still enjoying myself. As long as you still have a smile at the end of the day, I think that's the most important in life. And to round off Zverev's comments on the matter from the week, we had his on-court interview yesterday after he lost out to Daniil Medvedev in the final. He said the following. He said, one last thing. I know there is going to be a lot of people that right now are trying to wipe a smile off my face, but under this mask, I'm smiling. I feel incredible on court. I have the people that I love around me. I'm going to be a father very soon. Everything is great in my life. The people who are trying can keep trying, but I'm still smiling under this mask, even though you can't see. And that was, those were words and a sentiment that he repeated when asked to kind of elaborate and explain those comments in his press conference afterwards. So that's where we are in terms of Olya Sharapova's allegations and Zverev's response to them, albeit not a very detailed one at this stage. It's been a challenging week, David and Matt, for people like us and fans that follow tennis, because we don't want to be talking about this stuff or thinking about it, but we must. It can't be ignored.
No, you can't ignore it. It's those allegations are out there. That story has been done. We've all read it. You can't ignore it, and it's only right that we, as the media, give Alexander Zverev chance to answer them. As you can tell, he wasn't interested in elaborating or talking about the details that further came out from Racquet magazine. I was personally really quite shocked that he chose to say what he said on court. I really was surprised by that. I was watching the match. I watched the presentations, and I think one of the last things I expected was that he would take a position like that on the court, and I thought that was a bad move, to be honest, regardless of however he might feel. It didn't feel to me as though he was getting the tone right of the situation at all in what he said, because yes, he said that the allegations are untrue, he said that they are unfounded, but I don't know who he's talking to when he says, I know there are a lot of people trying to wipe the smile off my face. I don't really know what that means. I think that was ill-advised, to be quite honest. Reading a couple of days before that interview with Racquet magazine appeared, I was very interested in what John Wertheim had to say in his Sports Illustrated mailbag in terms of how we and the sport can react to a situation like this, because obviously it gets thrown around on social media. But so far, the ATP hasn't said anything. So far, as we've heard, Alexander Zverev has said very little. And so we're left with this vacuum. This is a few things that John Wertheim wrote in his Sports Illustrated mailbag. He said, first of all, these are allegations and not charges. And as always, the accused is entitled to presumptions. John then goes on to say, but these are serious, incredible accusations. And the idea is a few of you, in terms of his readers, have said that this is a she said, he said situation is really misguided. This is, John writes, She made a detailed allegation backed by supporting documentation and has a friend who offers a contemporaneous account. He responded clumsily in the same post in which he confirmed that a different ex-girlfriend is pregnant with his child. No criminal charges have been filed, though the statute of limitations in New York has not lapsed, and surely there is more to the story that is likely to emerge and will better inform judgment. But it is sloppy and wrong to suggest that these are simply two competing accounts that somehow cancel each other out. John then goes on to say, several of you have asked about the ATP's role here. Other, more conventional leagues have domestic violence policies that have been collectively bargained, often drafted in conjunction with a players' association. That's not how tennis is set up, but there is language in the ATP rulebook that could result in discipline. And he links to a page in the rulebook which I've read about players' behaviour and basically the reputation of the sport. The ATP ought to give serious consideration to ordering up an independent investigation, John writes. In a read-the-room kind of way, do you really want to ignore an alleged act of domestic violence committed allegedly by a top player during a tournament in a tournament hotel? This was not an alleged bad act on the order of doping or match-fixing that undermines competition, but if conduct severely damaging to the reputation of the sport is the standard, this would sure seem to threaten to meet the threshold. All the more so if criminal charges stem, which hardly seems out of the question. An investigation may absolve the accused. It's possible the accuser will decline to cooperate, but it's not a good look, as they say, for the ATP to do nothing when a woman alleges that a player, quote, tried to choke me with a pillow, hit my head against the wall, and twisted my hands. John then finishes up here and says, I asked an NBA executive how his league would handle this fact pattern. That is, if Zverev were an NBA player, what would happen? His response, he would likely be suspended provisionally with pay pending the outcome of the investigation, at least under the NBA's applicable domestic violence policy. Now, I subsequently went up and had a look at the NFL's policy, and they've had a lot of these sort of cases with allegations of this type, and it appears to have evolved over the last few years, this policy, and absolutely, it does appear that if a situation like this happens, they put the player temporarily on the sidelines while they conduct an investigation. That appears to just not be something that the ATP, I don't know about the other tennis governing bodies, but certainly in this case, hasn't been done at this point. And there isn't any suggestion, we haven't heard of anything to suggest that that's going to happen in this case. In fact, we've actually heard nothing from the ATP.
That's really interesting. I guess one difference is that the ATP is not a league like the NBA and the NFL, and players don't receive salaries. They have to play to earn. But I don't see why that would prevent an investigation being set up. I guess just the mechanics of it might have to be different. Just to pick up on what Catherine said, that this was, you know, kind of a sad week for the sport, and this massive stain on the sport and this blemish and kind of sucking away the joy we have for it. And I think there's a reason that we're all feeling that way beyond the actual allegations that have been made. And that's because of the reaction from both Zverev and from the silence from the ATP and the sort of tennis governing community as a whole. And I think those two things go hand in hand. I mean, just to look at the way Zverev's handled it, I think even if there was a thorough investigation carried out and it was found that Zverev is correct in saying that the allegations were not true, I would still find it troubling the way he's handled it and still find it disappointing. I think, firstly, that statement he put out, you said there, David, that John Wertheim described it as clumsy, and I really thought that was the right word, sort of juxtaposing his impending fatherhood with the very serious allegations against his name, I thought was weird and wrong, and the way he put the allegation as second on that statement, you know, kind of relegated its importance, I suppose, and almost was quite dismissive. And I think that's generally been his reaction to it. I mean, I know the notes app is the done thing for statements, but it just comes across as quite shoddy for what is actually a very serious matter, I think. And then he took that attitude further, as you said, in those on-court comments yesterday, which I thought were staggering, actually, in terms of not grasping the seriousness of this, and both in terms of tone and also in what he's actually said. Nowhere has he said, I abhor domestic violence and I'm taking this matter very seriously. That hasn't come up at all. And his voice matters. He's a prominent figure. He needs to be, I think, denouncing this sort of pattern of emotional and physical abuse and saying it's not okay. But then I think the ATP as well have got a role in this. And I think had the ATP come out with a statement or come out with some kind of announcing an investigation, I don't think Zverev would have been able to comment on it in the tone that he's used. I've not been that surprised that they've been silent or slow off the mark. You know, we look at the Gimelstob case last year. It took a while for him to be suspended, even though there was a lot of evidence against him. You can also mention the Basilashvili case, the fact that he's had a domestic violence charge against him since May and has kept playing. And there's been nothing said about that, as far as I can tell. And they're kind of using silence, I think, as a mechanism of trying to get by and hoping it goes away. And it's not going to. And I think actually in this case, the silence is kind of making things worse, because it's sending out this message that, well, it's sending out a message to any domestic violence victims that an alleged perpetrator, someone accused, can get away with it and can actually be celebrated. And I think no matter what the truth is, that's the reason that a lot of women find it very difficult to come forward about this when it happens to them. So I think those two things go hand in hand, Zverev's disappointing reaction and the reaction from the ATP. And I think if those things had been handled better, we'd have a better feeling about the sport handling this situation properly and doing what it can. And then I just want to finish just by saying that, you know, these are allegations from Olya that need to be treated with respect. And there are a lot of specifics. There's a lot of corroboration already to them. And I can only imagine the messages she must be receiving now. I mean, I don't even need to imagine. Someone sent us a screenshot of some of the messages on her Instagram. And frankly, it's disgusting. And there is this default skepticism, I think, when someone comes out with these allegations. And you saw it in the story. The people, Vasil, her friend, and Mrs. V, who's referred to in the story, Vasil's mother, initially not believing Olya and sort of wanting her to go back to Zverev. I found that such an important part of that story, and good on them for having the self-reflection to self-examine. But, you know, people bang on about needing to treat Zverev as innocent until proven guilty. But you need to, I think, extend that to Olya as well. The other side of the coin is you need to thoroughly investigate everything she's saying as well. And only then will we find out the outcome of all this. But there's a lot of processes that I just think should be happening, which aren't happening. And yeah, I think it's just been a disappointing reaction.
I think it's very well said from both of you. The default skepticism is something I've been grappling with this week, and grappling in the wider sense with the Believe Women slogan, which has sometimes been extrapolated out to believe all women. And it's something that the feminist movement has come under fire a lot about, and I think for me some of it legitimately. And I think for me what Believe Women doesn't mean suspend all your critical faculties and apply no scrutiny ever to things that women say. For me, it means listen to women and respect their stories and don't defaults to assumptions or default questioning of the credibility of the woman telling them. I think it's about interrogating yourself and your conscious or unconscious bias that you may well have when hearing stories like these. And yeah, for me, that's what that slogan means. And yeah, I found some of the responses, I suppose what's most depressing about them is how unsurprising they are. As you say, Matt, some of the responses on her Instagram are hugely upsetting. So yeah, I would urge that you read her account in detail and listen to it and maybe listen to it with some self-reflection about unconscious biases that we may all have. I mean, I absolutely respect Zverev's right to his side of the story. He is electing not to give us that at the moment, and that is disappointing. And what he is electing to give us, I echo both of your thoughts about that being even more than disappointing. Yeah, it's a horrible thing to be having to talk about, but as you've both said, silence is damaging. We can't just move on from this. So yeah, it's been a challenging week to be a tennis fan, unfortunately. Better week to be a dog fan.
Absolutely right. Yeah, very well said, both of you, I think, on that. And yeah, I hope that more of a reaction is going to be forthcoming. And yeah, taking the details of this set of allegations one by one and addressing them, because I think that that's what this and any case of this type requires.
Mm.
So I was just going to say one other player had spoken out in support of Ollier, which was Nicole Gibbs, after reading the Racquet magazine story. She actually tweeted that it reads like a memoir for victims of physical and emotional violence. And she's urging people to, as you said, listen and take it seriously. And yeah.
And those are, she and Daria Gavrilova are the lone voices among players as it stands at the moment to have commented on the situation. Just to extrapolate it all out a little bit to the tennis, makes me think of a question that we had in one of our listener questions episodes earlier in the year about Tennis Sangren. And it was from an American listener asking us whether it's acceptable for him to, or whether he should feel comfortable supporting Tennis Sangren when he watches him, given some of his views that he's expressed, that this listener and many, many others, I'm sure, would feel hugely uncomfortable with. And I can't quite remember what you both said on the matter, but my feeling was some people are able to separate tennis from the views and positions of those that play it, and that's fine. And some people aren't, and I think that's fine too. I've seen a lot of responses on Twitter from people, particularly women, saying, I'm uncomfortable with watching Alexander Zverev play tennis now. I'm unable to enjoy it. And whilst that's a dreadful shame, I completely respect that. But I also respect that some people are able to detach themselves and just enjoy the tennis. And I think people have very, very different responses in that way. And neither is right nor wrong. I think I drew the comparison about whether you can still enjoy Michael Jackson music. It's a debate I come to with my friends a lot. Some of them have thrown out his back catalogue, can't listen to it, can't enjoy it, and some of them can. And I personally think that's okay. He's played some great tennis this week, Alexander Zverev, and if you were able to watch and enjoy that, that's fine, I think.
What's that expression? The art is almost always better than the artist. And I think that certainly applies to a lot of musicians and their music, and you can extend that to sport as well, I think. Personally, I just found, as I said, it's just a blemish and a stain on the sport at the moment, and it's not necessarily specifically even Alexander Zverev matches that I felt less comfortable watching. I just felt a lack of joy watching the sport in general a little bit this week, given the, as we've detailed, the disappointing response.
Matt watched some doubles in an attempt to find a sort of safe haven of joy. tell us about the doubles, Matt.
Yes, I did enjoy seeing Felix Auger-Aliassime and Hubert Hurkacz, a couple of good eggs, I think, teaming up and winning the title in Paris. I think it's only their second ever tournament together, and yet they beat the number one seeds, the number seven seeds, the number four seeds, and then in the final, the number two seeds, Pavic and Suarez. And it was an incredibly dramatic end to the match. Pavic and Suarez had 5 match points in the second set tiebreak. They were all saved, and then it went to a match tiebreak, and Auger-Aliassime and Hurkacz couldn't miss. I mean, everything they hit just hit the line. Even all the miss hits were hitting the line. And yeah, they just had some very warm words for each other afterwards. And I was just uplifted by their victory, and thinking that they must be one of the youngest doubles pairings. I mean, I think them together is probably younger than some of the players on their own on the doubles court, you know. yeah. And it was one of those interesting matches. They were playing from the baseline. Pavic and Suarez were up at the net. It was just a good contrast of sort of styles. And yeah, it was a good story this week.
What happened to Herbert Mahou?
They lost. Oof. I joined the doubles tournament late, and they weren't in the final. I think they might have lost in the quarters.
Oh, a mixed week for bromances.
Indeed.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How much of the singles tournament did we all watch? I think all of our predictions died a very early death. Would that be safe to say?
Yeah, I was pretty excited about Alex de Minaur for about 10 minutes, especially when he went a set up against the eventual champion Daniil Medvedev, which I'm going to cling to, that the fact that he lost to the eventual champion. But it was quite interesting reading what Medvedev was saying afterwards, or hearing about what he was saying afterwards, I think to his wife, about how he just... how disillusioned he was with his own form. I mean, he's had a rough time, hasn't he, really, on the court of late. I mean, he's had some good wins here and there, but it's not been like last year. And then, yeah, there he was, a set down against Dimonor, and I think he won the next two 6-2, 6-2, and he was just off. He was off and running, and just playing that metronomic tennis of his.
We used the word.
There's that word. Yeah. Metronomic winning of titles has commenced. He was and he beat Raonic, you know, big server coming at him. And it was interesting watching a guy like Raonic just trying to decode the machine of Daniil Medvedev when Medvedev is on, you know, and particularly on a surface like that, that you've really got to do something special or he's got to malfunction. And neither of those two things were happening for anybody. Yeah, he played really well. He played really well, Medvedev.
He needed it, didn't he? Needed that week.
Yeah, I think I read that last season he reached 12 semi-finals and this was only his second of this season. I mean, obviously it's been a shortened year, but there's a huge disparity there. I was actually impressed. You know, you mentioned that kind of metronomic winning, and that is plan A, I think, for him. I was actually kind of impressed in the final with the different options he seemed to have at his disposal. He was occasionally serve and volleying. He was hitting quite a lot of slice backhands.
Mm.
And it kind of made me realise that there is actually quite a lot to his game. I think when he's at his best, I think we think back to what he did to Djokovic in Cincinnati last year when he completely changed his style mid-match to win. He is perhaps a little bit more malleable than I maybe often give him credit for, and yeah, he was impressive, and he's coming into form just in time for the ATP finals, obviously.
Yeah, which will be pleasing for him, I think, because at last year's ATP finals, when he was coming in off the back of a far better year, that actually ended up being to his detriment, those 12 semi-finals, because he just had nothing in the tank, did he? He was just sort of, he was a ghost of a man on the court. So I suspect he'll have his eye on the ATP finals, wouldn't you think?
I always find that a bit of a deflating experience to watch the ATP finals when there's the obvious player who's got nothing left in the tank. And last year that was Medvedev. You just saw, no matter how hard he pushed the foot to the floor, it just wasn't responding in any way. And he was a shadow of himself. And we've seen it in the past. I think Djokovic has tended to hit a wall once or twice. I mean, obviously he's had many, many years when he's won it, but it's usually been halfway through that he's hit the wall. Nadal has come in a lot of years just looking completely out of steam and unable to really play his best tennis there. But I think Medvedev's might have been the starkest yet last year from a guy who you just always expect to be able to bring a certain level, and he just couldn't.
Mm. Incidentally, the ATP finals lineup is now complete. It has been completed by Diego Schwartzman. He clinched the final spot in Paris last week. He did it by virtue of Pablo Carreño Busta, who was also in the running. Carreño Busta lost out to Rafael Nadal, which handed Diego Schwartzman his first ever qualifying spot in the ATP finals, which is a nice little story. I think going into last week, it was Carreño Busta, Berrettini and Schwartzman who were in with a chance. And it, to me, Schwartzman feels like the most valid of those to qualify, with all due respect to the others. I mean, Carreño Busta would have been a good shout as well. Obviously, he's had a great latter stage of the year, but Berrettini would have been qualifying off the back of his success from 2019 and heavily boosted by the adjustment to the ranking system, whereas Schwartzman has had some of his best ever results this year. It feels appropriate that Schwartzman is qualified to me.
Yeah, I think we have a field which reflects the best players of this strange year that we've had, and that's what you want at the ATP finals. I really understand why they adjusted the rankings, but for the sake of this tournament, I think it's important that we do have the players who've played well this year. You know, Berrettini got his chance last year, Schwartzman gets his chance, and Rublev get their chance this year. And there's a part of me that is anxious about the ATP finals, given everything we've talked about at the front of this episode, given the lack of crowd in such a big arena, but the fact that players hopefully are a bit fresher than they normally are, and the fact that we've got a lot of informed players there, there's a lot of potential, I think, for it to be an exciting week with a lot of good matches between informed players.
When you say, Matt, I understand why they did it, I presume you mean in order to prevent Christian Garin from qualifying. Because at the time they introduced the ranking changes, wasn't Garin in pole position?
Poor old Christian.
I mean, he sort of kept himself in contention for a while. But yes, it did feel a bit like a Christian Garin rule.
It wasn't. That was a joke, folks, just in case you didn't know. The Paris lack of crowd was the most jarring that I've experienced yet, I would say. I found that as was another reason that the whole thing was tough to watch throughout the week. I mean, I do agree with you. You know, the feelings that have emanated from this story and reading it, and particularly when the player concerned was playing, all of it has just been a tough experience to watch relative to the rest of the tennis circuit that we're used to. But when there is just nobody there in an indoor stadium like that, and it'll be interesting to see whether the O2 feels different in that regard, whether they can make the show such that it doesn't feel like this. But oh dear, it was a tough. It was soulless, really. Seeing blazing winners and silence, nothing. You know, it really hit me, actually.
Yeah, it was a flat week, wasn't it? It was a very, very flat week, and I don't have enough of a sample size of tournaments, certainly of the size of Paris, to know how much, even taking the Zverev situation out of it, how much of that is about indoor tournaments being particularly susceptible to the downsides of not having crowds. I do wonder if it amplifies the downsides. I mean, we will find out.
I think it does.
Yeah.
You've never got a plane going over or anything. You've just got nothing to break up the silence at all. And I think it's probably made worse by the fact that we've had some weeks with some crowd. Mm. So we've kind of just forgotten a little bit how quiet it was at the US Open. But at the US Open, there was all the music, for instance, and that they could have. And it just, that this was the weirdest of the lot.
Bring back the swag.
Absolutely. And the dog.
The swag, the dog, ATP finals, if you're listening, these are the things required to distract from an otherwise rubbish atmosphere. If you put mattresses around the court and put dogs on them, no one will notice that there's no crowd.
And player suites. I thought that was great at the US Open.
Oh, I thought
seems to have been abandoned.
Suites, SWEETS there. I mean, those would presumably be a boost as well.
Or suites for dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All of these things.
Dogs, I mean, and a lounger in your suite.
Suites must be possible in theory at the O2 Arena. There's only eight players.
Yeah. They've got that middle circuit, haven't they?
Yeah. It might be possible for broadcasters also. I'm entering the biosecure bubble on Thursday, folks.
Good luck.
Yeah. Prime are going to be on site with our usual studio at the O2 Arena. So I'm going to be experiencing one of these COVID times events firsthand. And although elements of it I have trepidation about, I'm looking forward to having experienced it and sort of looking back and knowing that sort of I was on the front line of tennis in its toughest time, I suppose. I think it, you know, listening to how Mary talked about the US Open, for example, I'm looking forward to sounding half as interesting as she does about the experience.
Well, and also, I mean, she was wary of the experience before it, wasn't she? And she wasn't 100% sure whether the US Open should happen and all that sort of thing. But, yeah, when she ended up going, she was really glad she did go. Yeah, you're going to be one of the few there. There's not going to be a lot of media on site. And, yeah, we'll look forward to hearing your stories.
Do you remember that podcast when we all thought we'd been locked in the O2 Arena, never to escape?
I've still got the video.
Well, I'm going to have that experience for 10 days.
Quite literally.
Yeah.
And you won't have Matt to lead the way, as we have then.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting. And there's going to be daily podcasts.
Hey.
From a first time podcasts have ever been done daily from a biosecure bubble, possibly.
From in it, yeah. Yeah, we've been doing them about them all the time, and we've been doing them about the bubble because there was no tennis. But we haven't actually done anybody. We haven't actually had anybody sort of, as you say, infiltrate it.
No, I mean, I think the whole point of a bubble is that it can't be infiltrated. I hope, anyway. Mm. The WTA Tour is reaching its slightly unlikely climax this week in Linz, Austria. And we were just going over the draw for this tournament before coming on air, and we were expecting everyone to show up for this because there's not been a WTA event for a couple of weeks. There's not going to be one now for a couple of months. And so we were expecting sort of everyone to rock up for the last opportunity to play some professional tennis. And it's an okay draw. Arina Sabalenka is the top seed. Elise Mertens, the second seed. You've got Nadia Podoroska, the French Open semi-finalist. Who else have we got? Veronika Kudermetova, Katerina Alexandrova, Yastremska's in there, Jill Teichman. But it's not the great and the good, frankly, that we were perhaps anticipating.
No, well, if you consider the eighth seed is Bernarda Pera, the 61st player ranked in the world, that's not a lofty top eight in comparison, as you say, with what I would certainly have expected. Looking down that draw, there's only two or three players that are non-Europe based. And if you think back a year ago, it was Coco Gauff who won the title. Yeah, it's. I mean, look, there's not a huge amount of prize money. It's $20,000 for the champion, going down to less than $2,000 for losing in the first round. And I suppose it's an isolated week, isn't it? There is no other tennis on the WTA Tour the week after, which a lot of the time the players would build in. I'm still surprised. I am surprised that more players just weren't desperate to get one more week in.
I think there's this tension or contradiction between players feeling very grateful to have the opportunity to play tennis and have tournaments to compete and earn prize money, and yet on the other hand just feeling fatigued and weary by what's been a sort of difficult stretch, I imagine, mentally and emotionally. You know, Goffin has talked about this on the men's side, and Nishioka, I think, as well. It's not normal. There's, you know, they're having to do constant testing. They're basically just in their hotel. And I think eventually that can take its toll. And maybe, as you said, given that this is just a one-stop event, some players have just thought, you know what, I'll just shut it down now. And, you know, we've had a decent run of events, take what we can get and kind of just focus on myself a little bit now and just try and have a bit of an off season before what's looking like a very early trip to Australia.
Yes. In terms of Australia, we have had some information coming out this week. It's increasingly likely that the ATP Cup will be played in Melbourne at Melbourne Park. So sort of creating a Melbourne bubble for ATP Cup and then the Australian Open. What will happen with the women's tournaments that would ordinarily take place in the build-up to the Australian Open. I don't quite know. What we have read in the Daily Mail this week via Mike Dixon is some comments from Craig Tiley of Tennis Australia suggesting that Australia might create a longer Australian swing, if you like, some tournaments beyond the Australian Open to keep the players down there sort of once they're in that bubble to make that stay sort of even more worthwhile. It's not confirmed at this stage, but it's something that they say they're in discussions about. And I can see the arguments for doing that. Absolutely. You know, once you're in a bubble, especially a bubble in a place that's, as Australia is, that seems to be doing so much better than a lot of the other tennis hosting nations at controlling COVID-19, and also obviously a place in the world that is this going into the downswing of the virus in terms of the seasons, it makes sense to stay there for as long as possible. Now, there are obvious downsides to it as well. It's a long time away from home for a lot of players, and other scheduled tournaments, they're sort of getting replaced, which would have financial implications for them as well. But if they were unable to stage themselves anyway, then is there any opportunity cost? I mean, the implications of all of these sorts of decisions are so far reaching, but I can certainly see why it's something that's on the table.
Well, I mean, there was the period back in the spring, wasn't there, when tennis re-established itself locally, not on a tour, but on its kind of exhibition circuit. And we had obviously the not so impressive ones like the Adria Tour, but we had the British swing. And in a way, this is almost like a little regional tour that Craig Tiley's talking to Mike about. And I think that for the next year, the ATP and the WTA are going to have to be as nimble as they can possibly be to just make things work, to just go along with initiatives like that and be innovative so that there are possibilities that otherwise they wouldn't have had to worry about in normal times. But in the current circumstances, that tennis may just not happen unless you're able to do things like that.
Do you think Craig watched Cologne 1 and 2 and thought, get me some of that?
I could well imagine him looking at that and thinking, and also the back-to-back Cincinnati and New York tournaments, and think, well, there's a seed of an idea there. Imagine what I could do with it. Mm-hmm. Because what one thing that Tennis Australia has shown itself able to do is produce in these. And when we go right back to when Indian Wells was cancelled and we had the what happens when tennis stops conversation, I always sort of looked at the Australian Open is having got so much time to work this out. Now, obviously, they've got to make sure the government gives them enough latitude to be able to act. But if anyone can do it and really do it well, I can imagine it would be them.
Mm. I think they'll come up with sexier names than Melbourne 1, Melbourne 2, Melbourne 3.
But I'd quite miss it now, though, now that we've got into that little numbering policy.
Perhaps they'll combine Cologne and Ostrava and it'll be Melbourne 1, Melbourne 2, Melbourne 3.
So you're just saying it missed out on exclamation marks. Otherwise, it would have worked. Mm. They were that close.
Roger Federer has been talking up his chances at Melbourne. What will it be? Melbourne 2? the Australian Open, anyway, seemed to become Melbourne 2 or 3. Can't quite work that one out. He, as reported by Simon Briggs in The Telegraph, has said he's preparing to leave Europe early for, quote, big Australian Open. Well, actually, it's his coach, Ivan Ljubicic, that's been making these bullish comments about how Roger Federer is recovering from the two keyhole surgeries he's had on his right knee over the course of the last 9 months or so. He says he's in the recovery phase, Ljubicic said to OK Tennis. He said, I would say that things are going in the best way. He trains more and more and better. There is a lot of confidence. So quite quite, I know these aren't from the horse's mouth comments, but quite different in tone to when Federer was coming into the 2017 Australia season after his first sort of real surgery and injury setback of his career. That was the it's a good draw because I'm in the draw tournament, you know, with no expectations, or certainly publicly saying he had no expectations. So I don't know, it's a slightly different approach. I mean, maybe he's furious at Lubicic for being so bullish, who knows? But I doubt it, because Lubicic is very careful with what he says, isn't he?
And he said very little, yeah. And since they've worked together, I mean, a guy as gregarious as Ivan, who does give great interviews, has just decided to not make himself available for any, and I know this because I've asked him for about five. I mean, mind you, he did take part in Tennis Relived, so we'll let him off. But yeah, I mean, he's said later in that piece, we want to leave as early as possible, play this big Australian Open, and then evaluate. But yeah, I can well imagine that Federer just acclimatizing himself very early, and us seeing a lot of, probably quite a lot of video of Roger Federer looking imperious in those few weeks of practice and whatever build up they're able to have are likely to be in our future.
Mm. Well, that sounds fine to me. Videos of Federer in the sunshine looking imperious, perhaps posing with a quokka. I'm here for it, and for the accompanying FOMO, which I'm sure will hit me very hard. Just one last bit of business from Australia. Another sad and distressing story that's emerged, well, everywhere really in tennis news, but it was originally in Sydney's Sunday Telegraph newspaper. Some comments from Nick Kyrgios about his struggle with depression, which he says left him in a lonely, dark place. He was talking in particular about a period in 2018, and he was really struggling. He says it wasn't just about tennis. He said there were moments when I was seriously depressed. He said, I remember waking up in Shanghai one year and it was 4 p.m. and I was still in bed, curtains closed. I didn't want to see the light of day. He said, I felt like nobody wanted to know me as a person. They just wanted to get a hold of me as a tennis player and use me. I didn't feel like I could trust anyone. It was a lonely, dark place, and things came from that. I just lost joy for the game, and I was spiraling out of control. He said, I fell into depression because of the things I thought I had to be, said Kyrgios. I was afraid to go out and talk to people because I thought I'd let them down because I wasn't winning matches. He doesn't say explicitly or specifically whether that's all in the past, and he feels okay. And I mean, obviously he's not played tennis since the tour's resumption, but I certainly hope he is sort of working on all those kind of complex emotions that obviously arise from playing tennis. It's no news that Nick Kyrgios is a complex guy, and that there's a lot more to him than the bravado he sometimes tries to give off.
And those words don't come as a huge surprise to hear that is his truth. You know, I didn't necessarily think he would say them publicly now or any time in the future. There was no assumption for me, but it's not a surprise that's how he was feeling, and that's the effect the tour life was having on him. And I think that it can easily be lost on people that don't do it, that aren't tennis players or don't travel the world with the tennis tour, and how glamorous it looks and how easy it can look and how easy someone like Kyrgios can make it look, that actually it's not always that easy. It can be very lonely, waking up as he describes, sort of with jet lag in the middle of the afternoon or something like that, in a place where you're not surrounded by people you want to be with necessarily. It can be very testing. I've heard this from a lot of players. I mean, cracky, I've experienced little bits of it myself, you know, just with the weirdness of it all. It's not home. And he is somebody who clearly loves being at home. So, yeah, anyway, wish him well.
It is going to be interesting when the tennis tour resumes, whether this period of enforced being at home ends up kind of refreshing him and kind of in a canister-y way, sort of replenishing his canister for the future, or whether that being at home just reinforces those feelings for him of how important that is for him and how much that is his comfort zone in contrast to the tennis tour, which isn't. It could go either way, couldn't it? It could make it more difficult to return to the tour. Well, I'm certainly looking forward to seeing him play in the Australian swing. In Melbourne's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Who knows how many there could be. Any more? Do we have any other business from the week that was, folks? And by business, I mean dog news.
Yeah, I don't have any of that. There's one little bit of coaching news, wasn't there? Felix Auger-Aliassime parting ways with one of his two coaches, I think it was.
Yes. The one that's not Freddie Fontang.
Yeah. And deciding, I think he's going to just work exclusively with Fontang in the future as things stand. But this is the time of year, isn't it? This is the time of year when you get all sorts of little alterations. I noticed Karolina Pliskova has stopped working with Danny Valverdeau. And he's also coaching Stan Wawrinka, isn't he?
And David Goffin has split with Thomas Johansson again.
Yeah, yeah, they've had a couple of periods of time together. Guillermo
Marx
is the long term coach of
Guillaume Marx. Is it? Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
The French, yes, which right. is the French version of Guillermo. Same vibe.
That was an appalling mispronunciation for me.
So that's going to be interesting. I mean, we have talked about I think the whole tennis world has talked about the need for some technical adjustments from Auger-Aliassime. So let's see. Matt, any more? Brackets dog news? Got anything for me? We'll accept Bruce Springsteen news.
No, I really don't. And I haven't got any shout outs today. We thought it was a bit of a downbeat episode to give people their shout out on. But I would say, in sort of related dog news, maybe a shout out to Russell and Brad. And,
yes.
You know, who were lovely Butler's owners. Yeah. Thinking of them and everyone in America, of course.
Yeah, we are. We're thinking of all our listeners. Definitely Brad and Russell, Steve and Joe, Cam's owners, who were, going through it at the moment. We're thinking of you. American Andrew, we're thinking of him as well in New York.
Yes, he's quite literally been affected by the election in that he was so consumed by, as you said, checking the various counties. He was even doing that while out for a run, and he ran into a tree while while checking the results on his phone, and now has a gash on his face.
Oh, but, no.
But as he said, it is the year of the mask, so when he's when he's out in public, he can at least cover it up.
Gosh, that's going to be a very memorable scar if it does scar.
He's in my bad books at the moment.
Anyway, it's the Bills.
Yeah, Buffalo Bills beat my Seattle Seahawks last night.
Right.
So I'm fuming.
That definitely is Andrew's fault. You've defected to a different type of football, because our type of football is going so darn badly on these shores. Yeah. There's no need to talk about that any further. We're going to be back with another podcast on Thursday. What are we talking about then?
Oh, we're talking probably about the draw.
Yep, tennis. We'll be talking about tennis, folks.
Little
teaser preview for you there. We'll be talking about tennis with another one of these podcasts on Thursday. It's been a pleasure to speak to you, even though it's not always been the easiest of episodes to record. But we'll be back on Thursday with another one of these. And stay safe, stay home if you're in the UK, and we'll speak to you soon.
Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.